Good morning. Welcome to our roundtable panel to start off our three-hour tour of broadcasting.
Right.
Welcome to the program. We would love to hear from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We have a terrific panel this morning coming up later in the hour. Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind. But first, commentator and activist Libby Post joins us. And it's a great pleasure to have Libby with us.
It's been a long time.
Well, it's great to be back, guys. It really is.
We love having you here.
And I miss you.
Well, we miss you. We have to take care of this.
Yeah, so, I know.
And then, of course, Ray Graff is here as well.
Yeah, well, whatever. He's always here. Get him out of here.
We miss you too, Ray.
All right, fine.
It's always great. Obviously, we are going to spend a good portion of this half hour talking about the Supreme Court's decision on Wednesday in United States versus Windsor to declare the Defense of Marriage Act that violated the Constitution, went further than the federal government ever has in extending equal rights to same-sex couples. But, as the New York Times points out this morning, it left untouched a thicket, as they call it, of conflicting state and local laws that deny gays and lesbians in the vast majority of states the benefits and legal recognition that marriage provides. So, as someone who has been such an outspoken activist and has done so much in this field for the LGBT community, let's first talk about emotion. What was yesterday like?
Oh, I was so happy.
Yeah. a good day.
It was just amazing. I mean, you know, who would have thunk 30 years ago when I was Alan's student, of all places, of all things, what we were dealing with back then and now we're here, and the amount of change that's happened within two generations for a social movement is just incredible. I mean, it doesn't happen this way. But clearly, relationship building, which I've always thought is key, is essential here, because it's hard to tell the people you love, your neighbors, your friends, your family members, your colleagues, no, you don't deserve the same rights as I do. And things have definitely changed.
So with this decision yesterday, there is a lot to celebrate. And yet, as the Times points out, and as I alluded to, there's still a lot of question marks, because the states have a lot at stake here and a lot of play in the game. And so the idea that this casts a magic wand across the country and makes all things equal is not really true.
Yeah, I really thought it was. And then I read the New York Times this morning and saw, because everybody was just so happy yesterday, and saw, you know, this, as you said, this thicket. If you're down south, where they certainly don't recognize same-sex marriage and have the amendments on the books there, if you live there, your residency impacts your Social Security, all of the other federal benefits. So if you've gotten married in New York and you live down in Mississippi and the state doesn't recognize you, it is very possible that you're not going to get the Social Security, you're not going to get the survivor's benefits, you won't get the inheritance tax waiver, as it were. And so, you know, I think what's going to happen is those states are going to see a gay drain.
Well, I thought this was an interesting sort of, there were two interesting points. One, that in a way, this was a decision about overarching federal authority. Okay. And they struck it down, which was good news for your side. Mm-hmm. However, that opens the Pandora's box of all the states' issues. And so, really, from a benefit standpoint, if you're married in Massachusetts or New York or whatever, you're cool.
That's right.
But There's a lot at stake.
So the question I have as a follow up to that is that, as the Time points out, and here's just a line from their article, a state line on a minister or a rabbi or a justice of the peace still decides who is married and who is not. This disparate treatment under the law is likely to remain unless the 37 states that do not permit same-sex marriage, same-sex unions, reverse course, or if the Supreme Court revisits the question in a broader case and issues a ruling that establishes a constitutional right to marriage. So, in saying that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional, What do the other states that don't have rules on the books, what are they using to sort of defend their right not to have those laws on the books?
The ones that don't have an amendment saying marriage is only between a man and a woman, those states?
Yes.
The ones that are in the middle there?
Yes, literally.
You know, I really don't know, because, again, it's going to go back to how they define marriage. And if they don't define marriage as between a man and a woman, then one would think that the decision yesterday would impact them. But, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't make a blanket statement. But if they don't define marriage as between a man and a woman, and people do who are married live in those states, it's quite possible that they have to adhere to the federal statutes unless they go and pass a law. But, you know, I think this patchwork that we're now going to be dealing with, you know, one of the things that this has done is between Prop 8, where they said that the National Organization for Marriage had no standing, and the DOMA ruling saying that discriminating against same-sex couples like this is unconstitutional, that you will now see a spate of lawsuits in the states that do have the anti-marriage amendments in their constitutions, to bring those, as well as the lawsuits, as well as ballot initiatives to overturn those.
I'm sorry, there's moths flying around.
I thought you were
conducting. All right, ready?
I thought you wanted the floor. Right. I was like, wow, Ray really has a point to make.
There are moths.
So yeah, okay. I didn't realize there were bugs in the studio.
I'll get the DDT. We'll be good to go.
You used a term a moment ago that I want to focus in on, and that is gay drain, which is, okay, so you have a state. Where this took place was Alabama.
Right.
So, all right, you're in Alabama, and you're a gay couple in Alabama, so you move,
to
right?
Massachusetts,
I mean, you move to a,
right.
I mean,
you
and that
move to
and
one
that
of the 13 jurisdictions.
But
yeah.
Hasn't that been the case? I mean, I assume
no.
It's, really?
No. I mean, look, people grow up where they grow up, and they want to live where they want to live.
Well, absolutely, and it shouldn't
you know,
be that way.
Right.
I'm not saying it is, but I. Yeah. But what I am asking is, I would assume that even, you know, now in the 13 states that do have it, that if you were across the lines, you would say, all right, well, this makes sense to be in an environment that is. Tolerant and friendly.
I would think so. I mean, you know, we never thought of moving to Massachusetts because I knew eventually New York was going to get a grip and pass it. But we didn't get married until New York passed it. But I do think that, you know, they're going to see those southern, not just southern states, but those states that have the amendments on the books, the DOMA-like amendments on the books, are going to see a gay drain. You know, because people are going to gravitate now that we know we can get these federal rights, okay, they're going to gravitate to where they can go to get them. Because as we age, and this community, not that we're totally aging out, but, you know, I'm 55, you know, retirement, Social Security, all that sort of stuff is playing a factor into it. We are in a long-term relationship. If somebody like me lived in the South, they might very well think, you know, in my retirement days, I'm going to move.
Reverse.
I'm
going to
move
yes.
from the South to the North, or to some place that values us so that this stuff is all taken care of and we don't have to worry about it. You know, also, you're going to see, you know, more and more Fortune 500 companies value their lesbian and gay, bisexual, and transgender employees. They more and more of them are getting 100s on the HRC Equality Index for workplaces. And so that has caused also a gay drain out of states where those corporations there don't value, and they go to the places where they do value. So ultimately, it might be there's going to be more of a population shift that will go to the states that value lesbian and gay couples, and those that don't will see a drain, and they'll see a tax drop off, and they'll see a lot of impact.
It's fascinating to me. I mean, obviously, this can be a red state, blue state thing. This can be. I mean, you can look at. I mean, obviously, the Northeast has this. Seems to be. Libby and I were talking about this before we went on the air. That you sort of get a false sense of security in the Northeast that. You know, there's more equality in the country than there,
right?
than there really is.
Yeah.
Which also makes California surprising, and still some major question marks in California as a result of this decision yesterday.
Well, it's the question mark is when it's all going to start.
Yeah,
you know, that's really the question mark. It's not. There's no question mark that it's going to start. It's
right.
Just when.
When. Right.
And I think it'll be sooner than later. From what I read, Jerry Brown's like, start doing this, folks.
Yeah.
Let's get going. You know, so I think that there won't be too much of a delay there, for people to start, getting married again. And for those folks who did get married, their marriages are now valid and legal.
So 13 states, mm-hmm. which I want to go back to your original point as if, you know, in imagining 30 years ago, but even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, where are we going to be? Is this a train that can't be stopped? And you hope that it is. And it seems that way, that eventually that train will make stops
everywhere. Yes.
To every state.
Right. I mean, I would have loved it yesterday if the Supreme Court had done a Loving versus Virginia type sweeping decision. There was precedence for them to do it. They did it for mixed race marriages in the 60s and, you know, with that decision. And there was precedent for it. But, you know, it was a different time back then. Socially, the idea of racial discrimination, you know, was really moving forward, repugnant. You had lots of things going on, and it was straight marriage. And so we weren't talking about what we're talking about today. I think that the Supreme Court is a lot more conservative than it was back in the 60s. And so while I would have loved for them to do the sweeping, they didn't. And what's going to happen now is that state by state, you're going to see lawsuits, you're going to see ballot referendums, positive ballot referendums like we had in Washington State and Minnesota getting on the ballot. And I think you're going to see more states. And look, once we get to that tipping point of 26 states, it's going to be really difficult for the Supreme Court, if a case ever goes back, to say, oh, no, we'll leave it to the states now.
Well, I mean, we've had Stephen Gottlieb on a few times now in the last couple of weeks with all the Supreme Court decisions. And I don't think the Supreme Court was in a position with the cases yesterday to make that sweeping situation. I mean, it was fairly sweeping with DOMA.
Mm-hmm.
But, and again, I get back to this, that it's funny that your movement finds itself on the conservative side in that case, in that it throws it back to the states. However, it's a double-edged sword in your case. Now it is back to the states, and Prop 8 is back to the states.
That's right.
So it's, you know, a sweeping federal decision was not in the cards in that case.
You're right about that. Although they could have if they wanted to, you know, but they weren't going to do it. But the idea that that what they did find in Prop 8 was that NOM, the National Organization for Marriage, had no standing. Okay, really speaks to the fact that no one is harmed by lesbians and gays getting married. It doesn't undermine your marriage, Joe. It doesn't. It certainly, Ray, doesn't undermine your marriage because you keep having children.
No, we're done.
Oh,
we're
you're done.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. So, I mean, I hope we're certainly done with me.
Okay, fine. Oh, I see. Fine. Yeah, we won't go there.
Yeah,
apparently has one.
I'll be leaving town.
Right, okay. Yeah. So, you know, that whole...
explains the moths.
Right, that's right.
What the hell does that mean?
The whole notion that traditional heterosexual marriage was somehow damaged by Lynn and I getting married is so fallacious that there is no standing for that argument, and there's no standing for those people. So, and people that were testifying on their behalf recanted. And now Exodus has recanted. I mean, there's lots of things going on here. So the fact that we are seeing that, you know, this argument that traditional marriage is being damaged is has no standing because that was their argument. You know, I think you're going to see more and more people moving, and the polls are showing a plurality of people support same-sex marriage because it's their friends and their neighbors and their kids.
So you mean moving philosophically or physically moving?
philosophically, and I think, you know, if some states like the South, which is where, you know, the Bible Belt, continue to do what they're doing. I mean, I don't think everyone's going to move out of South Beach anytime soon, but Alabama, Mississippi, the real conservative base where they really do hate us. I mean, they really do. I think you'll see people leaving because why? If you have this opportunity to be in a state where you are recognized, you can get the federal benefits, why stay someplace where they really hate you? I don't get that.
And you were telling me earlier, and I thought that was fascinating, but, you know, you said that you going down south with Lynn, that, okay, there's the fact that you're a gay married couple, but also that you're Jewish.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, some of this stuff isn't going to die.
No.
And
no.
It's not going to die anytime soon. I just want to go back to the fact that a day before, 24 hours before this decision was made, we're talking about the Voting Rights Act mm-hmm. of the 1960s, 50 years later, and saying, oh yeah, that's not right.
And Scalia, you know, really contradicted himself in those two decisions, and you know, it's like, hello, where you know, his personal bias came out really, really clearly. But yeah, the Voting Rights Act, you know, I think that was a bad decision and we'll pay for that down the line.
But what I wonder is that, you know, 50 years later, 50 years from now, are we mm-hmm. still going to be fighting this fight, the fight that we're talking about right now, in states and in places because that religious philosophy, that philosophy of whatever it is from wherever your background is so strong?
No, because of this, the trends, the younger folks, even the younger folks in the Christian right are questioning the homophobia and questioning the level of hate that's coming out from
right.
that's been coming out from the radical Christian right. So there's even a trend change within that culture where this shouldn't be an issue. This isn't what, you know, what Jesus told us, and I don't know, I wasn't there, but you know, but they're more.
She's only 55.
I'm only 55, I mean, right? You know, but you know, they're concerned with other issues, and so I think
there's love to everyone.
Yeah, there's the trend with the younger folks who are now voting. You're going to see when they become 30, 40, 50 years old, they're not going to vote for folks who are gonna spout this stuff. Jesse Helms will not be able to get elected in North Carolina in 20 years
right.
because of the voting trends and the age trends.
And when you think about the and it's such a good point to make about because it's our friends, because it's our family, because it's you know, that again, you get a Northeast perspective here, but mm-hmm. You know, so many of us have been to a gay wedding, you know,
right.
and you wouldn't have expected that. And now here it is. And then when somebody comes down with a court order and says, oh, well, you can't do that anymore, people are going to turn back and say, what?
Right.
Why? What? I don't get that.
Right. Right. What's the problem?
Yeah.
What's the problem? And, you know, and from an economic point of view, those states that are saying no are losing a good deal of money in revenue. And, you know, when I make this case, some people go, oh, you can't just bring it down to money. You know, what about the love and blah, blah, blah. And it's true. Love is there. But from a business point of view,
yeah. Money
millions and millions of dollars are going into the states that have legalized same-sex marriage. And the ones who don't are losing out.
Well, so in the 30 seconds that we have left, so we remain cautiously optimistic and still savor yesterday.
Absolutely. And I'm a little more than cautiously optimistic. I'm just optimistic.
That's great. Libby Post is a former WAMC commentator. You still write your blog,
yes,
for Times Union, which is great.
She's cut us off.
And what?
She's cut us off.
No, I haven't.
You'll come back. You'll do this again, won't you?
Yes, and I'm actually thinking of trying to get back to doing commentary.
All right, well, if not, at least come in.
We don't want to put you
us.
On the spot
yeah.
here.
No, I've been thinking about it for a long time.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yes.
We'll get you in that. Coming up next, we're going to take a break, and then when we come back, Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind will be with us. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel this morning. Ray Graff is here, my rock. Thank you.
Yes. And Libby turned into Jimmy. That's very odd.
Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind joins us this morning, and we thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, Ray.
This was a rare occurrence. This was a very rare occurrence because usually it is us begging people to be on the air.
Yeah.
Jimmy sent us a note last week and said, you know, I have some things to say about the end of the New York State the legislative session.
Are you lying about this?
No, this is true. And I said, oh, well, we'd love to have you, you know, like,
really?
Yes. He almost volunteered, which I think is.
Well,
is
he
good,
won't make that mistake
it's,
twice.
It's a good sign. I like that.
I figured it was either this or the fun drive.
Oh, no. Ouch. Ow, man.
I was thrilled. I was like, oh, good. You know, he's actually that's great.
Yeah, and then Joe, you're going to tell them about the guidance that you're willing to provide for the interview. I walked in, and while we were off air, I said, so, Joe, how do you want to do this? And he said, I'm just going to say New York State Legislature, yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to look at you.
It's the Larry King method. Marland Act. Go.
Well, you know, that is actually a decent place to start. So the legislature,
very nice, right?
as I think most listeners
nice
probably know, the legislature left town early Saturday morning. The Senate finished up. I think it was somewhere around 7:30 after going through the night. And one of the things that they didn't do was take any legislative action on this spate of public corruption that we've talked about here so many times before, which is surprising because there was lots of reason probably to take some sort of action about this public corruption. A poll taken in the last week of the legislative session showed 44% of New Yorkers listed this as their top priority for legislative action this year. And again, absolutely nothing was done. So Governor Andrew Cuomo has said he will convene a special investigatory panel under what's called the Moreland Act. There's a little known codicil of the New York state law that provides the governor power to implement these investigative panels of state agencies. And he says he's going to look at the State Board of Elections, which is responsible for keeping track of all the political contributions that all of our lawmakers get. He's going to convene a panel and look at that. And he says that quote, opens the portal into everything.
Mm. Oh, that's
everything.
A procedural question, if I may?
Of course.
About the Moreland Act. All right. So earlier in the week, or it might have been last week or last month, I can't remember anymore, there was a Moreland Act. They talked about the power situation.
Right.
And using this little-known surcharge to shore up power grid, you know, and making it harden it. Okay. My question for you about these Moreland Act commissions, what they say, their recommendations, they're only recommendations, right?
Correct.
Or are they law?
Absolutely correct. So that's a very excellent point.
These
commissions are investigatory, right? They have the power to subpoena. They can bring Ray Graff in. They can force him to testify under oath, yep, about whatever they so choose to make him testify. But they can't prosecute, can't level criminal charges, can't bring civil actions, and can't make laws. So their power really is sort of to bring a light on things that are perhaps unsavory, perhaps even illegal. And if they do find behavior that they feel is potentially unlawful, they have the power and a direct channel to forward their findings to some sort of prosecutor, be it a county level district attorney, be it a federal prosecutor, and at the same time that they do so, to make public exactly what they found. So in the instance of the Moreland Act Commission that was convened with respect to the Long Island Power Authority,
right,
and other state utilities.
And it went further than LIPA after a while. It kind of got bigger.
Precisely. And the commission found that there was evidence to indicate double billing by Navigant, a consulting firm, which I believe is based in Chicago. And they also found questions about former LIPA executives who went to work for Navigant. So this matter, they sort of laid it all out in this report, and then they wrapped a little red bow on it, put a little, you know, one of those sticky bows on it, and they sent it to the federal prosecutors, I think in Brooklyn. with a, you know, ICYMI note on the top of it, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens. But the same kind of situation could arise on the state level. And now it's interesting, right? Because all this state spending, right, all these contributions, all these expenditures of political committees, they're all declared, right? They're generally all declared. We know them. They're declared on a semi-annual basis, more often when elections are coming. So we know who's raising money from whom. But the real question that is going to be interesting with this commission is why? You know, why, Mr. Donahue, major donor, did you give $5,000 to Senator Graff under oath?
But does why did that happen?
Well,
if there's no quid pro quo, does it matter?
Well, okay. So
that's not happening, by the way.
Okay. No, because, you know, I'm about 5G short. And
so the questions become, is there a quid pro quo? And what about those emails, Senator Graff, that, you know, your office sent to Mr. Donahue that said, we can discuss your potential legislation at my fundraiser. The cost of admittance is $5,000. Isn't that questionable?
Senator Graff would be pretty stupid to put that in a phrase.
You know, I was a police reporter for a while before I started on the political beat, and I always had to remind myself, and the police officers would always remind me, that the bad guys aren't usually rational. So, So you know, you're right, but does those kinds of things exist?
Yeah.
I don't know. Are there similar things that go right up to the line? Probably.
Yeah.
I've certainly heard stories about the way the place operates. And so to really put that under oath, to force people under penalty of perjury to say, why did you give that money? And to either hear ridiculous answers, oh, you know, I like Ray Graff, big fan of the beard, or
nice,
not,
you know,
and right, you know, or not, is I that will be interesting to say the least.
Here's what I wish. I wish in mid-January we have a state of the state address, and the governor gets up and says, "This is what we need to do. This is the state of the state, and this is what we need to do over the next coming months." And then at the end of the session, they go up and say, well, this is what we actually did. And so you can sort of compare and contrast. If we were to do
that. Well, that's our job, though, right? To say what they actually did?
Well, yeah, but I'm interested in sort
their
of
perspective.
Yes, a perspective of what was
maybe
accomplished. It wasn't, you know, like a little bit of a checklist. You know, here are things, and this is what we got done on the checklist.
That's why I read Jimmy's column.
So
to find out what the heck happened.
Well, that's right. So the question is, how would that checklist look?
Well, there are some major areas that were not checked off, and let me just go through a few of them. The first is the idea of this women's equality agenda /act/acts. Now, this is a slew of proposals that Governor Cuomo unveiled in his State of the State presentation that called on strengthening pay equity laws, strengthening anti-discrimination laws, as well as a change to the state's abortion law, which would have removed abortion as an exception to a criminal statute, or largely removed it. There were some legal terms of art in there. And it would have created an affirmative right to an abortion along the guidelines of Roe v. Wade. And so Governor Cuomo spoke about the need for this legislation, as well as a broad coalition of women's groups that he assembled in support of this legislation, at a time when abortion rights are under attack in many jurisdictions. Of course, we're familiar with this proposal in Texas to define 20 weeks as the threshold for abortion and to create new requirements that pro-choice advocates say would effectively drive out of business, I think, 37 of 42 abortion clinics in the state of Texas. So the governor put this forward and nothing happened. We had the state assembly pass an omnibus version of this Women's Equality Act, 10 points, including the abortion plank. And then we had the state Senate, which is controlled by Republicans in coalition with the four-member Independent Democratic Conference. And the Republicans do not support this abortion plank, and they have said that there should not be a vote on the floor on this abortion plank. They split up the agenda. Well, actually, Governor Cuomo split up the agenda, and they considered it as separate bills. They passed 9 out of 10 and didn't take action on the abortion. But, of course, you have to have the same ledger in both houses. So New Yorkers ended up with nothing.
So, hypothetically.
Hypothetically.
Say I'm a governor who knows it's not going to pass. Why do I put it out there as a group when I know that item 10 is not going to make it through the Senate. Is this just burnishing my resume for possible future aspirations, or is this calling out the Republicans and conservatives saying, look, they're not going to do this. I told you they're not going to do this. Come next election, remember that they're not going to do this.
There are absolutely elements of both. And I certainly believe that the political considerations are major here. Because if you think about it, at the end of the day, this did not happen. This law did not become, this proposal did not become law. And what is the practical effect on New York women? Yeah. With regard to abortion, it is nothing. And so that makes one wonder, well, why do we need to do this? Why do we actually need to make this proposal? And this is certainly an argument that the opponents of this agenda made. But you absolutely describe the politics. Polls show that usually at a minimum, about 60% of New Yorkers surveyed on the question of abortion, on the question.
There's the moth. Enjoy.
I see the moth. Yeah. roughly 60% as a low moth. Point of New Yorkers in these legislative districts.
Friday's support at 1 these here things. On WAMC, by the way. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Now you've broken his train of thought. Continue with that, Jimmy. You're on to something.
It's about 60% in these legislative districts, and Democrats know that they can bludgeon Republicans on this issue. They know that they can particularly do it in the suburbs, and they can do it on Long Island, where there are 9 Republican senators. This is a big issue on Long Island. And as you pointed out, if Governor Cuomo were to successfully enact this into law, it would be a major line on his resume should he seek higher office. And just the fact that he is trying to do this, that he is pushing and investing political capital on this topic, is in and of itself a line on that resume.
But is it in fact investing much political capital if you know at the end of the day it's not going to make it anyway?
Well, the governor toured the state to talk about this issue. He made a speech at Seneca Falls, the site of one of the early conferences in the women's suffrage movement, to talk about this issue. The governor lent, I think, the full weight of his bully pulpit to this issue.
Yeah.
So yes, I do think there was a significant investment of political capital by Andrew Cuomo. At the end of the day, he can't control the actions of the state legislature. He can certainly pressure, cajole, and influence.
Yeah.
But no, I think he – I certainly would not describe his efforts here as half-hearted. Mm. That cannot be said in all issue areas this year.
You know, to quote Paul Tsongas in a 1992 debate with Bill Clinton in Manchester, New Hampshire, let us not forget that pandering works.
Ah! Oh, that was very well played there, Mr. Donahue.
We have just about 10 minutes left. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Jimmy Bielkind is our guest. He is the Times Union Capital reporter. It's a thrill to have him with us. And we'll continue our conversation after this short break.
Support comes from Capital Region Honda dealers, with locations in New York, Vermont, and Massachusetts, offering new and pre-owned Hondas. CapitalRegionHondaDealers.com. Healthy Living Market and Cafe, an independently owned natural food market providing natural and organic foods, now open 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. HealthyLivingMarket.com. And Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, Saratoga Springs, New York, providing nature gifts, bird seed, bird feeders, and more to help create a backyard refuge. WBU.com/Saratoga Springs.
In our remaining moments this morning on our panel, we want to talk about a couple of things, little items that are still
sure.
hanging in the air that
yeah.
we want to discuss
the
with. That's right, with Jimmy Bielkind, Times Union Capital reporter. We welcome your thoughts on any of the topics we've discussed this morning. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable@WAMC.org. And Ray, I know you had a question for Jimmy.
Well, there was a bit, and again, for some reason, maybe it's the fact that I had a cold for 2 weeks, but I can't remember what day, whether it was last week or this week, but there was the bit in the I think the AP had it, I'm not sure if you guys had it, about this casino legislation that finally passed, And there was a small omission from what was originally discussed.
Details.
Maybe you can explain that
to us. Yeah, details. So this is the kind of thing that people don't really announce the way they announce the glories of economic development and casinos and blah, 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 blah. But as originally proposed by Governor Cuomo, the casino enabling legislation contained a provision that would have prevented any gaming interest from giving political contributions. And Governor Cuomo had repeatedly said over the past 2 years that if gaming is done with politics, he wants no part of it. He'd be shocked to find that politics is going on in the process of casino siting in New York State. And so this provision was proposed by the governor, and it was quietly taken out. So the question is why
and by whom?
So the governor said...
Well, that was dramatic.
Yes.
even the moth took note.
Yeah. So the governor yesterday was asked about this very point. He essentially said, oh, I don't remember who took it out. These negotiations, they go late at night. I don't remember which draft was it. But it seems clear that it was taken out at the behest of one of the legislative leaders at the table. And instead, it was replaced with a provision that would require any entity regulated by the State Gaming Commission, or I think potentially regulated by the State Gaming Commission, to disclose if it gives contributions to some of these dark money groups, right? So under the glorious campaign finance laws of the Empire State and these United States of America, you can form, you know, New Yorkers for a Better Tomorrow or some group with a glorious name.
Yeah.
And anybody, including mega donor Joe Donahue, can give it lots and lots and lots of money. And it's very hard to link mega donor Joe Donahue to New Yorkers for a Better Tomorrow. And so the concern was that these casino groups would start giving money hither, nither, and tong.
Yeah.
So there is a provision in the bill that would require disclosure through the Gaming Commission if there were any political spending. Some legislators argued that it would have been an unconstitutional prohibition to say mega donor Joe Donahue, you cannot spend money. You cannot give politically. And I think that there are probably some valid constitutional questions there.
Sure, but doesn't it make you curious? Wouldn't you like to find out the legislator or legislators who said, look, we got to get this out of there?
It makes me curious, and it makes me a bit cynical about the entire process, frankly. You
weren't already cynical about the process?
Geez, that's funny.
You know, not until just now, Joe. Okay. This was it. I saw the moths flying from my mouth, and that was it.
I would have thought that would have happened like in March. All right.
But it does raise a big question about, you know, I shouldn't even say it raises a question. It's just yet another example of what happens after dark when the state legislature is in session. These things happen very quickly. They happen without a lot of public input, without robust public discussion. And voila, we wake up one day and this is the law. This is how things have been worked out. So we'll have to see how the casinos are sited. Of course, the bill allows for 4 casinos in 3 regions, the Catskills, the Southern Tier, and here in the Capital Region of upstate America. And we will see how that plays out. And we will also see whether the constitutional referendum that would legalize these casinos in New York, up to 7 of them total, 4 in the first round, is approved by voters in November.
And that'll be a big money fight, and it's coming to a theater near you.
Big money fight, theater near you. And frankly, I don't know where it's going to end up or who's going to line up where.
I just
let's ask the moth. Hang on.
I want to take just.
You got it. Jimmy got the moth.
Did he?
I don't think I did.
Murderer.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's send. We'll get letters.
Yeah. You know. How can you kill that moth? Dear WAMC.
In the 3 minutes that we have left, I put a flag on this in my inbox because it was just, I don't know, a few hours after the Supreme Court's decision, and I got an email from Eric Schneiderman, who is our Attorney General in the state of New York, and he is praising the decision. And today we made history, and talking about from the tone of the letter seems to be that he was partially responsible.
You get that a lot from people in politics.
And then at the end it says, sincerely, Eric Schneiderman, paid for by Schneiderman, 2014.
So here we go, right?
Well, yes, and I, you know, that's a classic example of own horn tooting by a politician. We got many, many statements from politicians basking in the glow of the Supreme Court's DOMA decision. But the Attorney General rightly points out that he did file amicus briefs in support of the Voting Rights Act, which, of course, had Section 4 struck down and invalidated by the Supreme Court on Tuesday, and in opposition to the Defense of Marriage Act. So I guess you could call Eric Schneiderman one and one in this week's Supreme Court action. But yes, thoughts will start quickly turning to the statewide elections in 2014. This is actually going to be an interesting period, not so much for the incumbent office holders, but for their potential challengers. This period is when potential Republican candidates for attorney general, and there was a report this morning that Michael Garcia, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, which is Manhattan, is pondering a run as a Republican against Attorney General Schneiderman. This is when they make the rounds. This is when they meet with donors. They talk to political consultants. They put together campaign teams, and they hit the rubber chicken dinner circuit, going to places like West Java for the Wyoming County Republican dinner. And let me tell you, gentlemen, if you haven't been,
You've been, haven't you?
It's worth the trip. Well, all right. I tell you. There was a nacho bar and four types of beer, three of which were Labatt. but so this is we're going to start to see more of that. We've already heard earlier this week Assemblyman Steve McLaughlin, a Republican from Scaticoke, the northern edge of Rensselaer County, say that he is considering a run for governor. And there are sort of echoes of Carl Paladino's gubernatorial run in his rhetoric and in his style and in, you know, the potential platform that he presented as sort of an anti-Cuomo critique. So so we're going to see that, and we're going to start to see the fallout from this year's legislative session. Will there be action taken against the members of the Senate Majority Coalition, the IDC? Will there be primary challengers lining up? Will we see this Moreland Commission embarrassing legislators? Will we see more legislators in handcuffs? It all remains to be seen, and that's what we're going to be watching.
And those questions will be answered on our next episode of the Roundtable Panel with our guest, Jimmy Vielkind, Times Union Capital reporter. Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you very soon. Also, our thanks to Libby Post this morning and to Ray Graff. We welcome your input, roundtable@wamc.org.